Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile Podcast. I'm David LaValle, and before I give you a little background on today's guest, I had a quick favor to ask. If you're enjoying our podcast, please take about 60 seconds to give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. That makes it much easier for other athletes to find us and to grow the tribe. Of course, if you don't like the podcast, please skip this step altogether. On a more important note, today's guest is one of the most influential figures in the history of American distance running, Hal Higdon. Hal was an accomplished runner in his prime, participating in 8 Olympic trials, but always coming up just short of the big prizes, like an Olympic appearance or a major marathon win. Those near misses never diminished his love for distance running, however, and Hal went on to run more than 100 marathons and won 4 Masters World Championships. Hal had an even bigger impact on the sport through his keyboard. He's written more than 30 books on running and other subjects and helped launch the first running craze in the U.S. as the longest tenured writer in the history of Runner's World magazine. At age 89, he still runs occasionally and is sharper mentally than most men half his age. Whether you're a running history buff or looking for training ideas for a race this year, there's something for everyone in our conversation with Hal. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there. How are you, Hal?
Good.
That's good. Where are you today?
I'm home in Long Beach, Indiana.
Oh, that's right. It's, I think I read somewhere that's overlooking Lake Michigan. Is that right?
I just turned to the right and I can see Lake Michigan right now. It's a little bit calmer today than it was yesterday because of the winds. We can look across the lake and see the skyline of Chicago on clear days.
Wow. I had to meet someone at Northwestern a couple of years ago, and I went for a run around campus. I'd never been there before, and there had to have been a 35 mile an hour wind coming off the lake. And
right.
You must have some wild winters there.
Well, yeah, we're not here in the winter. We're down further south of here, so we don't bear the brunt of the winter anymore, although I spent a lot of good time cross-country skiing and running in the cold weather, which actually can be very, very pleasant on a clear, sunny day like today.
Now, I have friends who are into Nordic skiing, and they will say, even on a full moon night, you get a clear full moon night, and with that moonlight reflecting off the snow, you can get in a good long ski in the 10 o'clock at night.
Right, and there's really a bunch of excellent Midwestern ski areas to the north of us, about a 3 or 4 hour drive in and around Traverse City, Michigan, probably about a half a dozen areas that with 450 feet max aren't that great for downhill skiing, but some really, really world-class cross-country ski trails. So one of the things I sort of miss that we're in Florida now is the ability to get out on my skis, but life changes.
No, it's... Well, and we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, Courtney DeWalter, who you may know of as one of the most accomplished ultra runners in the world now.
Uh-huh.
And she grew up as a Nordic ski racer in Minnesota.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And then went on to University of Denver and won a national championship with that team. She really credits that Nordic skiing background with giving her some real strength and grit to get through ultra runs.
I went to college in Minnesota, and so I identify much with the people up there in the north.
I bet. Yeah. No, it's there's some good runners who've come out of Carleton College, right?
Yeah, we've had some pretty fair ones. And in fact, I think one of our walkers, skiers, have been on the Olympic team, which I never quite made, but came close.
I know. It's one of the things we wanted to ask you about. So you went to the Olympic trials 8 times, I think, if we have that right.
Yeah, it was easier to get in at that time because some of those trials were the marathon trials. And back in the era, you couldn't get more than 50, 100 people to show up for a marathon race other than Boston. So I had that opportunity, but qualified also for track and field trials. I guess my high point was in the 60 Olympic trials where I got a 5th place, but that's a couple of notches away from making the team.
What did you need? Top 3?
Top 3 made the team. And I was running against some pretty good competitors, Phil Coleman, George Young, Deacon Jones, and they were obviously a lot faster than I was. So it was my honor to run in their way.
That's all right. That's all right. And then in 64, I think, did you run in the trials again in 64?
64, right. The trials were at the Yonkers and also in Culver City. The Yonkers trials were run in like 95 degree heat. So basically wiped everybody out. Even Buddy Edelin, who won the trial that day, was 10 minutes off his world record. And probably ruined him for the actual Olympics, where he got sixth place, which was good. But you know, Buddy had the ability to run in the top three if he hadn't been destroyed by the weather in that one trial back then, many years ago.
Wow. And did you? So you ran the marathon trials in '64, not the 10,000 meters or the steeplechase?
No, I sort of focused on the marathon. Actually, I focused on the Boston Marathon. I wasn't really focused on the Olympic team, but I felt that I had a good shot at maybe winning the Boston Marathon, which would offer me enough of a stature to go on with the rest of my life. And so, you know, I had a good shot at it, was leading at 19 miles, but got passed by a couple of runners who obviously were superior to me. So it was both a high point and a low point.
No, understood. And just backtracking for just a second, but so did you, of course, one of the most iconic American distance races of all time was Billy Mills at the 64 Olympics. So did you cross paths with him at all, any of the trials?
Well, I was never quite competitive at Billy's level. I beat him a couple of times when he was in college and had not quite matured as a runner. But we had an opportunity to run against, I ran for the University of Chicago Track Club. We had a couple of Olympians that I already mentioned on our squad. And the coach at Kansas was looking for good competition. And so we sometimes went out to Lawrence to run against his team. And I remember Billy being on the team at that point, and he had some bad races and some good races, but the good races were superb races, particularly that great race in Tokyo where he blew everybody away in the 10,000 meters. I thought actually, because he had qualified in the marathon, he would have more luck, maybe a medaling in the marathon. I believe he got somewhere behind Buddy, but boy, he just sort of had one of those great lifetime experiences.
Yeah, no, that was an amazing feat. And so that was interesting. So he'd have some peaks and valleys, and sounds like maybe somewhat unpredictably, and just happened to catch a life.
That's typical of a lot of young runners. You know, every race is not perfect. I've had some pretty bad races too, and I've had some pretty good races. But when you do look at the couple of the key points of Billy's career, of course, the 10,000 meters at the Olympic Games, but then it was at the following year when he and Jerry Lindgren had a battle it out to the end in a 10,000 meter race at the Nationals, set a world record, or maybe it was a 6 mile world record. So really showed everybody how good he was.
Yeah, no, it was a great story. And so, but what you're a student of the art of running and the science of running. So what, have you ever been able to put your finger on it? Well, what makes one day a great day for a runner, and the same runner 7 days later could have a terrible day?
Well, training can be tricky. You know, there's a danger that you can undertrain and not be quite at your peak shape. But if you're overtrained, it's even worse. I think looking back on my own career, I overtrained more than I undertrained. And I had a couple of disappointments because of that. Races where I thought I had an opportunity to do really well, and I merely did well. So I think if you had a long running career, you know, you're going to have some good races, some bad races, but even the mediocre races are fun, because the training to get that shape, I think, is what pulls a lot of runners along. I've done some surveys with the people who follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and a number of them, probably a majority of them, feel that it's the training itself for the marathon that is the height of why they do it, not so much the marathon itself. It's sort of like the marathon is the ultimate goal that drags you out on a Sunday morning to go 15 to 20 miles, and you finish that workout exhausted but exhilarated. And the carrot is definitely hanging out there for everybody's runners today.
Very good. That's a great outlook. And but your thought is that this is, you know, whether you perform well on Marathon Sunday or Marathon Monday here in Boston, that it's more science and training based, not just luck of the draw. You don't just wake up one morning and say, oh, this is a good day or a bad day.
Well, sometimes it is a bad day and you can't help it. I mentioned that race in Yonkers that was, the weather was up in 90s. Another race was the so-called Mount Holyoke Marathon, which was the Pan American Games trials, I believe it was 67. And I was pretty much totally out of shape at that time, and went just there to have fun and meet my old friends, and started way slow and back of the pack. And I was running like 50th, 60th place for a long while. And then I suddenly was moving up from 40th to 30th to 20th, and eventually in the top 10. I wasn't passing anybody. People were dropping out because of the heat. So an out of shape myself actually had a greater accomplishment than I had 4 years earlier, 3 years earlier, when I was running in the Olympic trials in the peak of myself, and I couldn't succeed because of the weather. You know, sometimes the wind is in your face, but if as the wind is behind you, you run with the wind.
I think Woody Allen once said that 90% of life is showing up, right? You got to show up. You never know what's going to happen.
If you're not there, you're not there.
That's it. So, I'm curious about Boston. So, you were leading 64, you were leading, I think, at the 19 mile mark, which is right before the meet of the Newton Hills and Heartbreak Hill.
Well, exactly. So I believe I took the lead with about a mile before the start of the Newton Hills, right at the firehouse where you take a sudden right and there's four hills awaiting you. And I led up through the first hill, and I was about halfway up the second hill, and I looked to my left, and the photo truck was going by me. With right behind the photo truck was Aurélie Vandendresse of Belgium, the European champion and the winner of the Boston Marathon for the previous year. And he was smiling and waving at the photographers, and that pretty much ended it for me. My good friend Ron Wallingford of Canada went by me, and a couple of Finnish guys went by me, and I sort of picked it up by the time I got over Heartbreak Hill and started catching up, and so I had a good finish in fifth, but it was not the win of Boston I had hoped I had to do. So I crossed the finish line, and I was crying because I had failed to win the race, but I also was wonderfully happy because I had blown my fastest time away. So it was a career best PR. It doesn't sound that fast now, but back then it was, I think, one of the second fastest time, and it run by an American. So we have successes and failures, and sometimes they come on top of each other.
And when you think back about your training for that race, are there things you wish you had done differently?
No, I think I was well trained. I think, you know, I ran the perfect race. It's just that I was up against a bunch of guys that were better than I was, including one of the Finnish runners who I almost caught. He got fourth, and I was about 100 meters behind him and, catching him, and ran out of course. So basically he finished fourth, I finished fifth, first American. And then a half a dozen years later, I was now a master athlete, and I went with a master's team that ran in England and in Helsinki. We ran a 10,000 meter at the Olympic Stadium in Helsinki, and I had a great race. I won the race that day, set an American master's record, and one of the Finnish runners came up and introduced himself to me. It was Pavel Pistonen, and it was the runner who had finished in front of me half a dozen years before. So if you keep going, you know, if you keep running, by the time you get aged at me, you get a chance to outdo all of your rivals. Just stay alive.
Are you still running now?
Sort of. You know, I don't want to admit that I'm not running as much as I used to, But knowing I was going to be talking to you, I started counting up the years that I've been running, and I've been running for now for 75 years.
Wow.
Not only that, but my main event was the 3,000-meter steeplechase, which you would think would destroy everybody's knees. I was still running the steeplechase even in my 60s, won a World Masters Championships at for the M60 division. But I've managed to hang on with a variety of different exercises, running being one of them. But I have to admit that I probably put a little bit more miles on the bike now than I do on running.
There's no shame in that, man. You are off the couch.
Well, if I make a goal now, I no longer have a goal of making Olympic team or winning a gold medal. My goal is to get out on my bike with my wife and ride to our favorite coffee shop, have coffee and a donut, and then ride back home. And that plus the other exercises we do to keep us in shape.
That is great. And so when you think back, you know, kind of rewinding to Boston again and reflecting on what you just said, by the time of Boston, you realized that running was a really big part of your life. May not have realized it would be your kind of life's professional calling as well. But what is it about the sport that resonated so much with you?
Well, for one thing, I was pretty good at it. So I was getting feedback of, I was winning races, at least small local races, even into my 50s, and which irritated a few of my younger rivals, but so that was certainly part of my motivation. But the other part of it was that I just enjoyed doing it. I'm lucky to live in the Indiana Dunes near some of the best running trails in the world, particularly Indiana Dunes State Park. And so that brings out the pleasure syndrome, I guess, in me. The fact that I could get together with my running buddies, and for a long, long time, members of the Dunes Running Club would meet on a Saturday morning, and we'd go running in the state park together up in the sand, in the hills, anywhere from 60 to 90 to even 2 hours, minutes and hours. And so it's just a lot of fun to run solo. Most of my workouts would be solo because it's more convenient. You don't have to jump
sure.
in and meet people. But still, on those occasions, I would get together with my running friends, and it was just very enjoyable. So that was the motivation. And particularly, I came along at the right time when David H.R. Payne, the San Diego attorney, founded the Masters movement for runners over the age of 40. And so I had gone through about a period of about a half a dozen years where I continued to run, but without any great running goals. And then by the time I crashed 40, I suddenly discovered I was the fastest Masters runner in the country and also in the world in a couple of occasions. So that sort of motivated me along. And but after a while, you win so many medals, and there are other reasons why you continue to participate in the sport. And in addition to your running, I got involved in a midlife crisis into the triathlon for a number of years, except it kept getting, every time when I get a good bike, somebody would get a better bike. Cross-country skiing became my go-to sport in the winter, something I could do with my wife. And so, everything sort of carried me along, and I was lucky enough to be part of a fitness revolution. When I first ran the Boston Marathon in 1959, I believe there were about 100 runners in the field. And during the 60s, I wrote a few articles for Sports Illustrated on long distance running, including one on the Boston Marathon that came out in 1963, the week before the Boston Marathon. And the following year in 1964, when I showed up at the starting line, it was like about 100 more than usual. I think we had 300-400 in the race that year. And a number of people came up to me and said that they started running after they read my article in Sports Illustrated. Some other people have had more maybe credit due to them. Ken Cooper, whose book Aerobics was a bestseller in the 60s, that was part of it. And of course, Frank Shorter, you can't overlook the value that came from his gold medal in 72, and maybe even more, his silver medal in 1976 when ABC, covering the Olympics, took the sport seriously and really featured Frank. And I think a lot of people, particularly even more than his gold medal performance, were inspired by his silver medal performance. And by 1977, the running boom was on its way, and I was fortunate enough to grab the coattails and be carried along with it.
So it was about that time. Well, you'd been writing for Runner's World almost, I think, from the second issue ever onward. Is that right?
Second issue, right. Yeah, it was Distance Running News was the name of it. And Bob Anderson, who was a high school fan back in Kansas, asked me to write something for his next issue. And I sort of would have been tempted to brush off something like that because time is money. But I had written an article for Sports Illustrated on Ted Corbett's run at the London Brighton race. So I dug it out of my files and I handed it, sent it to Bob, and he put it in that second issue. So I've been able to sort of claim a longevity over any of the people that have been in and out of Runner's World since then. But before I wrote anything for Runner's World, and for about a decade, I didn't accept any money from what was a sort of a fan zine at first. My full-time profession was as a freelance writer. I was very rare that I was able to sell an article on my Sports Illustrated. I was very lucky to have a couple of editors at Sports Illustrated, Andy Crichton, Walter Bingham, who were also runners and ran Boston. So they appreciated what I was doing, and usually I was able to write a few articles on running for them. So that was at the point where running was beginning to take hold of the populace, would grab them in the 70s through 80s, 90s, and through the new century.
Well, and that was the golden era for Sports Illustrated too, right? I mean, the magazine really started to explode at that point, and the quality of writing in that magazine, I think most people kind of forget that, but they had really high editorial standards. They recruited some amazing writers, obviously amazing photographers too, but that they set the standard for the quality of sports writing for decades to come.
Oh, I agree, including my good friend and rival, Kenny Moore, who pretty much succeeded me at Sports Illustrated. He started writing for them, and so it was a lot tougher for me to get assignments because he was picking off some of the good ones as well. I was able to see Kenny a year ago at a reunion we had in Alamosa, Colorado for the 1968 Olympic trials that were held there. But yeah, he was a first-class writer who was actually sort of a contributing writer for them, so he carried them for a long, long time. But you're right, because back at that time, Sports Illustrated covered the mainstream sports, but they also sort of had at least one article in each issue, which was something that was well written about any different sport. And a lot of my writing for Sports Illustrated was still on running. I was also doing other things for them. I can think of one article I did about a guy who was a model airplane buff and competed in model airplanes. Another about a kid that was a drag racer who'd go out at midnight when the police weren't looking and race his buddies. So, Sports Illustrated was doing things that other magazines were not doing. If I had to look at the magazine today in this era that is almost the leading running magazine, it might not be Runner's World. I think it would be the New Yorker, who carries a number of articles on running and various sports, so and covers the Olympics as well. So that they feature good running, good writing, and every now and then good writing is something about running.
That's great. So, and what did it feel like back in that era? I mean, you were right in the middle of it. You were writing for Runner's World. You were competing. You were in Olympic trials. I mean, it's sort of like living in Haight-Ashbury when the Grateful Dead was launching, right? I mean, you were right in the thick of a huge social revolution and sports revolution. But what did that feel like day to day? Did you sense there was a bigger movement afoot, or did you just say, oh yeah, I'm running, my buddies are running, I write a little bit about it?
Well, I was just going out for my daily runs. And actually, we can sort of skip back another decade, if you'll allow me to.
Absolutely.
The real founder of the running movement, as far as I'm concerned, is Browning Ross, who was a two-time Olympian in 68 and 72, and was doing some coaching in Woodbury, New Jersey, and who published a newsletter, the Long Distance Log, which each monthly issue covered literally every race in the United States, which wasn't many races. So Browning, sort of copying the British, who had a Roadrunners Club there that organized and sponsored races, got a number of people together in 1958 at the Paramount Hotel in February to discuss about doing a Roadrunners Club of America. And we all sort of went to that. I happened to be in New York for the National AU Track and Field Championship. I was running the 3 mile in Madison Square Garden. So I was attended Browning's meeting, went home, and a bunch of us in Chicago started to organize a few races, and other people started to organize races in Detroit and Kansas and California, where there weren't any road races before. And that sort of put the groundwork to, in the 60s, would come along with the beginning of the running boom. I mentioned that when I ran, the Boston Marathon in 1959, there were only about 100 runners in the race. There were no qualifying standards. You could walk up to the gymnasium and enter the same race day. But by the end of that decade, and I take a little bit of credit because of my Sports Illustrated articles, there were 1,000 runners running the Boston Marathons, and Jock Semple and Will Clowney, who organized the race, were in panic mode because they didn't think they could tolerate more than 1,000 runners on the course. And so it was that point when they were trying to cope with 1,000 runners and trying to limit the number so we wouldn't have more than 1,000 in Boston. They came up with the great idea of having standards, which was first you had to have run a marathon before somewhere to be allowed in Boston. And then it was going to be a 4-hour marathon and a 3:30, 3 hour, and eventually down to 2 hours and 50 minutes. And what they didn't realize it was, in setting these goals, they were motivating a lot of ordinary, in quotes, runners to achieve at that level. We had a runner, Ron Breischaft, on our running club, and he sort of raised his nose to those of us who were going to Boston in the 60s, et cetera, et cetera. And then they got the standard down to 250, and he sort of took attention because he thought, I can do that. So that became his goal. He got his 250, he ran Boston. He was a pretty good runner, but not a great runner. And more runners all over the country, all of them men, by the way, were doing the same sort of they would show up at the races. And by now, by the 70s, there were the beginnings of major races in the big cities. New York City Marathon, I believe, got its start, I believe, in 1971, was it, with when Fred Lebow moved the course of his marathon from a dreadful course near Yankee Stadium to Central Park, extended the start all the way to the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. The Chicago Marathon, in its first year, actually was the largest marathon in the world until New York, a month later, caught up with it. So you had major races that were now attracting 4,000 or 5,000 runners, and then 10,000 runners, and then, oh my God, particularly in the 70s, women started to run the race. They had never been allowed even to run the Boston Marathon because everybody knew that women would not be able to run more than a mile and a half.
Right.
Otherwise, their uteruses would drop. And so the women started getting involved, and to the point through the 80s, and the 90s. By the 90s, I think the women's revolution was in full storm, to the point where now I believe the women are really sort of carrying the sport.
That's right.
We used to look at the numbers about 5 years ago, and about 60% of the marathoners in the country were men, 40% were women, more women running half marathons than men. But now I believe, even now, the women have caught up in the marathons, and I don't have the figures, the data to prove it, but I believe there are now more women running marathons than there are men. Certainly, if you look at the people who follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and my grandson Jake sometimes crunches the numbers, about 75% of my followers are female. Females.
Wow, great.
Those are the people who are the number one leaders of the sport. They're buying all the running shoes, are buying the good running clothes so they look great while they're out doing their 20 milers. So you know, they've taken over the sport, and nobody doubts their ability to go 26 miles anymore.
That is the truth. And so when did you get the idea for, you wound up writing what a lot of people think is at least one of the top three books in the history of marathon running, Marathon, The Ultimate Training Guide. When did you get the idea for that book?
I just more or less discussed it with the book publishers at the Rodale Press. At one point in the 80s, I wasn't doing any books. I had written a couple dozen books before that on varying subjects, including somewhat running. And the publishers and I more or less sat down and said, why don't we do a book on the 10K at that time, at the end of the 80s, into the 90s. The 10K was the most popular running distance at that time. And the people at Rodale wanted to do a 10K book. And I was the most visible author working for the Runner's World, which was published by Rodale. And so I wrote a book called Run Fast, which was basically mostly about 5K and 10K running. Had a lot of success, sold over 100,000 copies, I'd say, in its first year or so, and continued on. We've had three editions of the book over various years, and that was a success. So they Rodale then asked me about a year or so later, why don't we do a book now on marathon? And so I did a book, Marathon, The Ultimate Training Guide, and coincidentally, I was beginning to coach a few runners, which is another subject we can talk about a little
right.
bit. And so the book came out and was very, very successful. Probably sold 250,000 copies or more by now into five editions. So I was really sort of able to profit from the sport, which I never had anticipated doing back when I was running Boston in the 60s. I was doing it for the love of the sport, not because it was going to make me a lot of money. So I just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
And did you describe, if you would, the research that went into the book? Obviously, you had decades of experience at that point, lots of firsthand experience. But did you tap into kind of scientists and physiologists and other running coaches to put this together?
A lot of scientists. I had a very close friendship and relationship with David Kostel, who was director of the Human Performance Laboratory in Muncie, Indiana, Ball State University. And Dave would bring me down to be the guinea pig. He'd put me up on a treadmill and test me, and along with other runners. So I began to accumulate a lot of scientific knowledge about the sport. But particularly for the first edition of the book, I sent a questionnaire to about 50 or 100 coaches. And the Roadrunners Club of America had a program where it would certify coaches. So they had the number, contact emails, et cetera, et cetera. I guess we were doing emails back then, or are we still licking stamps on envelopes? I'm not even sure. So basically, I sent questionnaires to these coaches, and they were all kind enough to respond to me. And a few of them I might have picked up the phone and called and did interviews. So the first book was really on the coaches itself. And then what happened is that in the 90s, the Chicago Marathon, under the leadership of Kerry Binkowski as race director, began to expand. And so Kerry wanted to have a training program for the Chicago runners. Mm. He enlisted me to develop a training program. And so the next edition of the book was what I more or less learned from the runners with the Chicago Marathon training classes. We have as many as 2,000 or 3,000 runners who are participating in half a dozen locations all around the city of Chicago. So the second edition really sort of brought in the tales and stories of the people in the training class. By the time of the third edition, I had begun to develop a social footprint. Didn't know at the time that there were footprints like that. But people started to follow. They started out with a question and answer column I did for Runner's World on AOL. Does anybody still remember what AOL is?
There's still a few AOL email addresses kicking around out there.
A few email addresses out there. But anyway, Runner's World asked me to do that, which I did for a couple of years. And then Carrie asked me to put together some training programs that they could offer online. And so I got involved in doing training programs on the internet, which people should purchase. I'm now up, and so by the third and fourth and now into the fifth editions, I was able to tap in the source of all these people that were following my training programs. And I had them all up on my website. At first there were marathon, novice, intermediate, and advanced, but eventually expanded to literally 40 or 50 different programs, everything from 5K all the way up to the ultra marathon. And so basically I developed the programs online, came away for free, which was nice because the Chicago Marathon was funding that, and developed the following, was able to expand it, eventually ran into a partnership with Training Peaks in Boulder, Colorado to produce training programs that people could sign up and get a daily email from me and now be able to click on an app. So things just expanded into something that I had never anticipated before. I sort of got into coaching by the back door without coaching a college team or like that. But again, it was the opportunity to be in the right place at the right time and take advantage of that and also help a lot of runners reach their goals.
Well, and you described what I think is one of the key evolutions of training for amateur athletes over the last 20 or 30 years. If you rewind 25 years ago, there would be a beginner, an intermediate, and an advanced training plan. And it was kind of one size fits all, depending on which category you fit into, right? But as we all know, and you've proven over the years, you could be an advanced runner and make great progress with 130 miles a week, or you might be an advanced runner who makes progress with 70 miles a week, right? And so how do you think about for your students, right, your athletes who are following you, how should they understand which plan is right for them? Am I a high mileage person? Am I a speed work person? Am I a hills person? How do you recommend that they dial that in?
Well, experience counts. And if you've been running for 2, 3, 4, or 5 years, you probably pick the level. You go into my website and look at the various programs there and pick the level that you're at. And if you ask me, I will probably tell you to pick a level that's a little bit below your ability. So with the beginners, you know, I try to urge them to get in shape first. And so many beginners, God love them, their first goal is to run 26 miles, run a marathon. Maybe a little bit less these now than it was 10 years ago. I think a lot of runners come into the sport and the half marathon now is their early race. And maybe they even ran a 10K before that. So they come in and now they have the marathon, and I sort of guide them into the novice program because I, you know, first do no harm. And as I began to expand my programs more and more, I added a novice one and a intermediate one and an advanced program. So now I have 6 programs. So if you had been running for a year or two and you'd run a bunch of 10Ks and half marathons, you could skip the novice one program and you actually go to novice two to begin. So I try to sort of guide them, whether they reach me on Facebook or Twitter or figure it out on their own, into a program. And now with the magic of what we do on the internet, I've now got an app. You can go into the Run with Hal app and you can start running with the app. You can set your goal and the app will read what your training was and decide, well, maybe if you ran a 6 mile or your longer one, you can do 8 miles next week or the week after that. So the magic of the electronic revolution actually will allow runners to be automatically coached. And, you know, I still think you're better off if you're self-coached, if you have a coach that can actually see you, can stand by the track and yell your splits to you, like Ted Hayden, the coach at the University of Chicago track club, used to do for me. There's so many opportunities of runners to learn the sport. And, you know, they just go into the internet and they can get swamped with advice and information. You know, hopefully if they land on one of my programs, it's good information, and probably a lot of the other stuff is good too.
And have you enjoyed the coaching part of it? Has that been as fun for you as competing?
Yeah, I think it's very successful. It's a big high to be able to be part of people's lives. And what I think is so, to me, is the fact that now it's not just Cal Higdon doing running programs or somebody's going to be running the Chicago Marathon if he can get in, because now they limited the 45,000
sure.
runners. But I have people all over the world who are following my programs. I was interacting today with a runner from India, for instance. One of the country that has the most followers, according to my data people, Ireland. I have more runners following me from Ireland than from any other country in the world. I think that's only fitting because my grandparents came over from Ireland years and years and years and years ago. So the fact that there are so many people who speak a language that I can't understand, I see their writing onto my website, and it's some, I don't even know what country they belong to, but I God love them, because they're just people all over the world that who are able to appreciate the sport. I thinking back also some years ago, my wife and I decided to take a vacation to Argentina because we had some frequent flyer points from America Airlines, and this was as far away as we could go with that many points. So we set up that round trip to Buenos Aires.
Great.
So on one of the days, we were on a tour that was going to go to a gaucho ranch. And so we're now at the gaucho ranch. We saw everything there, and we were standing around with 20, 30, 40 people. And this one fellow came up to me, and he was from India, and he said he used my training programs to run the marathon.
So that's great.
American runner talking to a guy in Argentina, in South America, and he's from Asia. So and I think that, I can't help but be happy to see the imprint that not only I, but so many other people who also contribute to the, I'm always, for instance, referring people to Nancy Clark's website, dietitian.
She's great.
The book, her sports nutrition guidebook, has sold even more copies than mine. I don't have to worry about telling people how to eat, because I just say, go buy Nancy's book.
And what are you, so most of our readers and listeners are pretty dedicated runners. So they're 5-6 day a week people, probably run 10 or 12 events per year in a normal year, of course. At that level of runner, what's the biggest mistake you see them make in their training or diet or recovery or sleep? But what are the recurring problems, not for the newbies, but for the people who should know what they're doing?
Well, one of my problems was running too many races.
Yeah.
I think what really held me back was the fact that I love the sport so much that I wanted to get out there and race. You know, so even the year when I had my big success at Boston, I had run a previous marathon in Chicago, the Windy City Marathon, won the race. And four weeks before the biggest race of my life, you got to be kidding, Higdon. You're not screwy enough to run another marathon before that marathon. And not only that, but in between the two marathons, I went out to the National AAU 30 kilometer race out in Maryland, won that. And so basically every weekend I was running a race. It worked out for me, certainly the year I ran my fastest in Boston. I'm not sure if I would have run faster, had more success. One or two occasions, I think, particularly the Olympic trials in 1956, it would have been 10,000 meters. I overtrained for that and got injured and had a less than successful race, but it took me a while to learn my own lesson.
I'm sure. And then what you mentioned Nancy, but what in your advice to runners, what are the biggest mistakes you see on diet and nutrition?
I hate to get the keto people mad at me, but I think people get into a low carb diet, and too many times I would be interacting with runners online, and they would tell me how they were struggling and having difficulty doing the long runs. And I would ask them the question, well, what are you eating? And I would discover that they were not eating enough carbohydrates. Carbohydrates, God love all the people who are on different diets, are the most effective fuel for running a marathon. And I think the ultra marathoners, they may need a different diet. I know that I don't want to argue with them, but I think that you start out by a diet that is very well loaded with carbohydrates, and you go from there. At various times, I used to get a regular physical exam from Ken Cooper down at the Aerobic Center in Dallas, and usually part of that exam was they would have you do a three-day diet of everything you ate, and then you would consult with their nutritionist there, and she would discuss what your diet was. So I would fill out these diaries, and then when I talked to the nutritionist, the RD, it turned out that my diet was within about 1 or 2 percentage points of 55% carbohydrate, 30% fat, and 15% protein. And that's pretty much, according to my nutritionist friend, the golden standard when it comes to eating right. And I didn't do it because I was following any specific diet. It just so happened that that's the way we ate. And every time I would take a test, I would be like 56% or 54% carbohydrates. So I was sort of lucky because I was married to a woman whose parents were from Italy. My grandparents were from Ireland. So basically that meant Irish Catholic, we would have fish every Friday. Italian, we would have spaghetti every Wednesday. So those were two of the dinners that we had, and we'd fill in with fruits and vegetables, and the diet worked out correctly. I think Nancy will tell you that one of the kingpins for dietary success is to have a good breakfast. And my good breakfast typically is to have a grainy cereal, a granola type cereal, raisins on top of that. And then depending what's in the market, I will put raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, bananas, whatever's in season, and just sort of basically pile it up. And then orange juice as well. My wife will do me a single piece of toast. That's the beginning of my day. That plus her own smarts when it comes to good food sort of keeps us going. I hate to confess though, that one of my bad habits today is my bike rides, which I will do early in the morning to our favorite coffee shop for coffee and a donut. So that's sort of a little reward, I guess you would do. And on the days when I will have been a bad boy like that, I sometimes will have breakfast for lunch. So I have my rather than in the morning. But I try to eat healthy, and I'm very lucky in having a woman who's put up with me all these years and knows how to cook.
Well, no offense to my own half Irish heritage, Italian cuisine is a heck of a lot better than Irish cuisine. So you married well there.
Right.
And there's a lot of research saying that among popular diets, let's call them, that Mediterranean diet does seem to keep coming up in study after study of being a pretty healthy, well-balanced diet, right? There's plenty of carbohydrates, lean proteins, olive oil, a lot of good stuff in there.
Well, I think, you know, we're all very aware in the days of the coronavirus on the necessity of trying to do all we can to avoid catching it. And I felt, and I posted it online, is that there's three things that can really help with you. First of all, mainly in building your immune system, is exercise. You know, we're running. If you exercise, I think you strengthen your immune system. Nutrition, also strengthening your immune system. And third, what Dr. Fauci says over and over and over again, wear a mask. So I think that if you can do that, you can avoid to a somewhat, no guarantee, it's just my personal opinion, no data, I have no data at all to back it up, but my personal opinion is exercise, nutrition, diet, and mask. I think hopefully cross your fingers, we can all get through it until the vaccination, we're able to get a vaccination this winter or spring.
All right. I'm probably going to insult you by going down this road, but many of our listeners at this point probably don't realize that you are 87 years old. How old?
89.
89. All right. Wow. All right.
And so I sometimes hide it, but that's okay.
But there have been a couple studies recently. We've published these or linked to these in our newsletter. But every study that comes out seems to say that exercise leads, and particularly endurance exercise, leads to mental acuity. I'm not just flattering you, but I think most of our listeners would say, I don't really believe this guy is 89 years old mentally. So do you find that in your personal life? Do you feel like that this your exercise regime and healthy living keeps you sharper mentally?
Oh, no question. I think no question about it. I think it's a whole body thing. It's not only, I just feel there's so many good things about it. For a long time, a good friend of mine was Ralph Pfaffenbarger. He was on the faculty at Stanford University. And Ralph was the one that did the famous study on the Harvard alumni, which discovered that the Harvard alumni who exercised lived an extra, I think it was like 2.4 years longer than the Harvard alumni who did no exercise. And that was the best study that was had. And one of the times when I was down to see Ken Cooper in Dallas, probably writing an article about him, which I did for Runner's World and one of the other magazines, Ken told me that if you exercise regularly, you'll live 6 to 9 years longer. And I thought, what? And so I asked him, I thought maybe I had not heard him. He said, yeah, that's correct. 6 to 9 years. And Ralph Pfaffenbarger, when he did the Harvard alumni, he was dealing with paper, you know, records, paper records of the alumni. He wasn't able to talk to all these people. But Ken had over 1,000, several thousand probably people and continuing coming into his aerobic center where he had a team of doctors who were helping them taking with their fitness routines. So he had the hard data to back it up. And of course, I've outlived my father by a couple of decades and outlived my mother by a decade from the ages that they reached. My father died of a heart attack at age 69. My mother, similarly in her 80s, they both had been smokers early. I had to grow up in a family that was smoking. Eventually my father gave it up, but so, you know, they didn't have the ability or the knowledge that we have today to realize the effect that exercise and nutrition can have on your mental acuity, I think. Although I have a hard time helping my wife with her crossword puzzles because I can't always come up with the same answers that I used to be able to 2 years ago.
Well, you're forgiven. You have the social media following that a teenage girl would envy. So you're doing something to keep yourself at least mentally young on social media.
Yeah, I try to post a tip of the day every day on Facebook.
Love
I've
those.
Got a friends program and then the open program that's open to everybody. I usually post the same stuff on both, and then I go over to Twitter and we'll tweet a few things that's not going to get me in trouble politically. So, and then people will interact with me. Fortunately, not everybody discovers how to reach me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a real life, but I do enjoy the opportunity of the people that post on Twitter, and I sometimes, as much as I can, react, including, for instance, that runner from Bombay who happened to talk to me this morning.
I love that story. All right, well, you've been really generous with your time and thoughts. I will we'll hit you with a couple quick questions, which we've hit some of our other guests with a little rapid fire round, if that's all right with you.
Sure, I'll try to not talk as much.
No, that's not at all what I was implying. But so we will. Well, I'll start out with a question based on what you said. But if you ruled the world and you could eliminate the iPhone, if you had that power, would you think the world is better off with all these smartphones running around, or were we better off before them?
Well, in many respects, it would be better off because it's forced us to not communicate with each other. So I see these people walking through the parking lots, looking at their phone and wondering if they're going to get hit by a car because they're not paying attention. And I think that is a danger. But on the other hand, it allows us to communicate so much easier. And
no, as well as the parent of three teenage kids, I'm in the mode of I wish they had never been invented. But if you asked me 5 years ago, I'd say I love it. And if you ask me 5 years from now, I'm sure I'll say I love it again.
Three kids are a little bit older than being teenagers. All of our grandkids now even are. I think we've got about one or two grandkids that are in the teenage. One of them graduated from Wayzata High School this spring, and then everybody will be out of the nest for our kids, at least our three children.
All right, good perspective. Favorite movie of all time?
Well, if you're talking about a running movie, I would say it's The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, tied with the documentary Olympia, the Leni Riefenstahl film of the 1936 Olympics, the Nazi Olympics. So a lot of people get mad at me when I say that because he is not favored by everybody, but it's a superb movie if you can look past the politics. If you're looking at a real movie, I would say Cool Hand Luke with
my
all-time favorite. And I forget which child of our three kids was getting married, but there was a period between the wedding and the reception. And so we had people in the house, and Cool Hand Luke was on a reel praying continuously. So I have that memory that not only connects to me as one of Paul Newman's greatest films, but one that resonates to me from a family.
Oh man, no, great film. The egg eating scene and the religious overtones to it. And it was a really cool film.
Yeah, Paul Newman did not get as much credit as he deserved for being a really great actor. He should have gotten the Academy Award for that. His supporting actor, George Kennedy, did. But they gave Paul an Oscar 5 or 10 years later for a movie that wasn't quite as good, but still he got the honor.
A makeup call by the rest. Amen. All right. How about favorite book of all time? Not allowed to say one of your own.
Ernest Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea.
Oh, how great.
I was in the Army at the time, and I was in Germany, stationed for a while in Kitzingen and then later in Stuttgart, which is 7th Army headquarters, and didn't feel like hanging out in the bars every time. So one of the places I hung out was the camp library. And I remember walking into the library at one time and going to the stacks, and this was about a year or two after The Old Man and the Sea came out, and I picked it off the shelf. It was a pretty small volume, started reading it, finished it while I was still standing there. I might have sat down to finish reading it in one reading, and that's always been my favorite. Maybe Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby coming in a close second.
Those are two great choices. Now, not to digress, we'll have a follow-up call or a cup of coffee on this, but my dad was stationed in Garmisch, Germany in the U.S. Army at the exact same time, probably. He was there in the early 50s.
And I was there in the 50s, 55 through 56, and that's where I made my biggest breakthrough as a runner. I went to Germany, had the opportunity to train pretty much full-time under a friend of mine, Frank McBride, as coach. Doubled my distance mileage and took a whole minute off my 5,000 time by finally getting some decent coaching.
Wow, good. I love that. If you could have dinner with one person, deceased or alive, who would you love to have dinner with?
Well, the name that suddenly popped into my head was Barack Obama, but...
You know, that is the most popular answer. We've had 15 or 16 guests on the podcast, and that name has come up the most. That's interesting.
Yeah, maybe if I had Michelle there, too, that would double the pleasure.
All right, we won't go down that road. Do you like running with a GPS watch or not?
I do. In fact, I've got one, just in visual, but I got one right on my wrist right now. And what I love about it, it's synced into my app, my Run With Hal app. And so I'll go out for my bike ride or for my run, and I'll come in and I'll do the quick synchronization, and a map of my workout sort of pops onto my iPhone, and it tracks basically what I had just done, either on biking or running or walking or anything like that. And I think one of the things is we're looking for things to motivate you. And I know the feedback that I've got from the people who have purchase my app. This one very important modifier is if you keep a record. For me, years and years ago, I used to plan my training out like a year in advance, and I would get a big sheet of paper and I would turn it into a calendar, and I would put the training that I was going to do and the training that I did. And that was one of the motivators that kept me going along. So I think a training log on a watch or anything, even just on your refrigerator, is a huge motivator in keeping you going. And most important, we didn't talk too much about injuries or how to avoid injuries. If you do get injured, you can look up on the wall and see them.
Right. Yeah, great point. All right, two more quick ones. When you're really at your highest mileage, were you morning runner, afternoon runner, evening runner?
Both, all three.
Yeah.
Because you can't do mileage like 100, 110 miles a week unless you're running twice a day. So an easy day for me back in my peak training would be go out for a run of 8 miles on the beach in the morning, and then another run of 8 miles on the beach on the afternoon. That was the easy day. No speed work, just a nice float in a very, very scenic area. So basically that was my training.
Great. And last question, when you look back at your life and career, who has been the most important mentor to you?
I think Fred Wilt. Fred was an Olympian, 1948 and 1952, 10,000 meter runner. I ran against him in the trials when he made the Olympic team in 52. And he was an FBI agent who was assigned eventually to Lafayette, Indiana, a 2-hour drive from where I lived in Long Beach, Indiana. And so when I was starting to focus my training, I wanted one last grab at winning the Boston Marathon. So in 1963, and I had known Fred very closely for 4 or 5 years when he was coaching Buddy Edelin, who set the American who set the world record in 63. And so I got Fred to coach me over a period of 3 years, and I had my most success running for him, where he was I would send him a diary sheet every day, every week, all my diary sheets, just like Buddy did, and then he would comment on them. So he was my motivating factor right then. I wish I'd had as successful coaches all my running career as I did then.
Well, that is great stuff. No, we can't thank you enough for spending all this time with us and great insights. I've got a page of notes that I want to publish these in our newsletter. You've got a lot of great references to movies and books and studies and the Human Performance Lab. So I want to gather those all together and obviously link out to your site. And this is really great stuff. And we may beg your indulgence again and dive into a little more of this because I agree. I would love to. I mean, one of the biggest concerns for our readers and listeners is always injury recovery and injury prevention. That we could do a whole conversation just on that, but thank you so much, Hal. This has been an absolute pleasure, and I hope the world gets back to normal soon and these vaccines kick in, and we can all get back to seeing each other in person.
That's what we're praying for.
Fingers crossed. Amen. Take care, Hal. We'll be back in touch soon.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.